It's great that you could come, Rupert. Really, really good.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Yeah, really good to see you. So I thought what we'd start with is... I thought we'd start with an experience I had. Anyway, there you go. I've got to start somewhere. So I wanted to try and use this little story we were just chatting beforehand as a kind of place to start, yeah? So I was, a while ago, in summer, I was on a month-long solitary retreat. In our tradition, we go off on, you know, retreats with no phone, no contact with the outside world for a month. And I was on this quite intensive solitary retreat, meditating a lot. And one time I was I did my little walk every day to the end of the valley and look at the goats, which was the most exciting thing that was happening in this very deserted part of Spain, the mountains of Spain. And I had this experience, which I've had before, in fact I've had since I was a child, which is that I suddenly sort of stopped and have that sort of sense that if I died here in these mountains in Spain, it's a very high up mountain valley. It sounds absurd now I try and talk about it, but nothing would care. You know, I'd fall down dead. You know, the goats would be interested in me for various reasons. But the rocks, the trees, it's nothing to do with me. I would be dead forever. My consciousness would be snuffed out. Now, that isn't a Buddhist view, of course, as we both know. But again, I was struck by it. You know, I've been practicing Buddhism for many years. And I was struck by how deeply I've still got that idea that here, who I am, me, is the only bit of the world that's there, that it stops at the periphery of my body, that once I die, you know, that the external world has no connection with me whatsoever, and even is sort of not just distinct from me, but separate from me, even alien from me, and therefore, if you very quickly, threatening to me. And of course, that means that because that world outside is alien to me, I can frack it, I can mine it, I can use it as a rubbish dump because it's not alive, and soon I won't be alive, yeah? That struck me as a basic materialist, metaphysical materialist view I had there, that my consciousness was locked inside me, inside my brain, that everything outside of that was not me and had nothing to do with me, that life might exist in other brains, in the goats to some degree, and in other human beings, but nowhere else, and that when I die, you know, I would be obliterated, yeah? So that, what struck me about that, and the reason I wanted to talk to you about it, is because that's still after many years of spiritual practice of trying to undo that view. It's a view, I remember it started for me, that view, when I saw my father asked me to come and see my grandmother when she was dead. And I remember this sense, well, I was only about eight, and I remember this sense of, you know, I went to see my grandmother. I loved my grandmother very much. And my mother said, oh, she's asleep. And I thought, she's definitely not asleep. You know, I have seen her asleep. She was often asleep, and she is not asleep. And then my father said, I think she's gone to a better place. And I thought, I can't see any evidence of that either. But what really struck me about that experience was that they didn't know. Even when I was eight, I seemed to know that they didn't know what happened here. And I remember thinking, this is a major problem we've got here. This is a major problem we've got here. And nobody clearly knows about it. It wasn't as conscious as that. So I thought we'd try and start with that, what I would call a metaphysical materialist view. You know, Charles Taylor, who you quote, talks about exclusive humanism.
Yes.
Sort of bounded humanism. That there's nothing beyond the mind. Why is that wrong? How is it wrong? Because it doesn't look wrong. And then perhaps we'll talk about how did we get there?
Well, since the beginning of science in the 17th century of modern science, there has been this attempt to separate minds from nature. I mean, the whole of science as we know it is based on splitting mind from nature. It's the well-known Cartesian dualism. And one of the key steps in that was the discovery by Johannes Kepler, who's best known for his astronomical work, of his theory of vision. Kepler was the chap who worked out how vision works, in the sense that light comes into the eye, it goes through the lens, and you get small inverted images on the retina. Now, no one knew that before Kepler. And it's partly because he did it for, he came to it because people had already been making lenses for spectacles. In the Middle Ages, some people already had spectacles. So they knew about lenses. And they had the camera obscura, which is a dark room with a hole in it, a pinhole, and you get an inverted image on the wall. And Kepler put these together and worked out that that's what's happening inside the eye. So when you see something, there's these small inverted images on the retina inside the head. And this was part of a debate about vision that had been going on since ancient Greece. And the reason for this is that it's all to do with where the mind is. That's why I'm mentioning it. In ancient Greece, most people thought that when you see something, the images you see are where they seem to be. Like my image of you is located where you're sitting. That's the common sense view. And all over the world, that's what most people believe. And it's what children believe. And so what Euclid, the great geometer, worked it out in detail. And he said that when light comes into the eye, there's a projection of images that goes in the opposite direction. So what happens is light's coming into my eye, changes are happening in my brain, and then I'm projecting out my image of you to where you are. So it coincides with where you are. It's outside me. It links me to the world. Every act of perception links me to the world around me. And you're an image in my mind, but you're not an image in my brain, because my image of you is where it seems to be. And Euclid then said, well, you can actually see this. When you look at something in a mirror, the mirror, he didn't use this phrase, but the mirror is basically a beam splitter. The light is reflected by the mirror, comes into your eyes, but you project out the image of what you're seeing. And because it's virtual rather than physical, it goes straight through the mirror. So the images you see are located behind the mirror. So you're projecting out the world you see. Now, the reason I think this is very important is because before the 17th century and before Kepler's discovery, everyone, more or less, took it for granted that we're connected with the world. We're not just inside our heads. Even the simplest act of vision connects us with the world around us. We're interlinked. Our minds stretch out into the world. And if I look at a star, my mind stretches out over literally astronomical distances to connecting me with that star. I'm projecting out the image of the star. So what Kepler then said is that the inverted images happen inside the head, and it's just light coming in. There's nothing going out. And then people said, well, actually, we don't actually experience two inverted, small inverted images of the world. We just see one image of the world that seems to be out there. How do you explain that? And Kepler said, oh, I can't explain that. It's not my business. I'm doing optics. You know, it must be somewhere inside the brain. I leave it to someone else to explain that. And that's where the situation has remained ever since. The thing is that Galileo then followed on with the idea that the world out there is made up of physical matter with weight, mass, momentum, etc. But qualities, our actual experience is located inside the head. They're secondary qualities, smells, colors. They're not out there in the world. They're inside the head. So this then gave us the idea that the head, that all our experience is located inside the head. Now, in 17th century science, there was also a spiritual dimension, and Descartes' famous split said, well, actually, everything in the material world is made up of unconscious matter. But there's also the realm that contains God and angels and the human consciousness, higher aspects of consciousness, especially those that can understand maths, which is what science is supposed to be about. So, and these come in the realm of consciousness or spirit, which is not in space and time. It's supernatural, beyond nature. Then, of course, what happened is that in the 17th and 18th century, that worked quite well, because what it did was got religion out of nature, And God was removed from nature into a separate realm. Nature was left to the scientists. So science could get on with studying nature, and religion could get on with talking about God and angels and morality without too much interference. But in the 19th century, there were a lot of people who said, well, two things is too many. We don't want two kinds of reality, we just want one. And so one school of thought, which included Hegel and a number of German philosophers, said the only reality is consciousness, and matter is kind of dumbed-down mind. Mm. The others said the only reality is matter, and the so-called realm of spiritual consciousness and supernatural realm simply doesn't exist. You can't measure it, you can't see it, it just doesn't exist. So you've just got matter, materialism. And that, of course, is an atheist point of view. You got rid of God and the angels at the stroke of a pen. And then human minds then become nothing but the physical activity of the brain. So that's why in the modern world, people have been brought up with that view. They think their consciousness is all inside their head. And that when you die, the brain decays and that's the end of it. But I think if you actually look at the roots of that, it was partly in the 17th century where Kepler was cleverly working out the nature of light and that's role in vision, nothing wrong with that. But then without it actually explaining vision. And it left all these subjective things completely unexplained. And as you know, the biggest problem for materialist philosophers is what's called the hard problem, is the very existence of consciousness. Because if the whole universe consists only of matter or physical reality, and if all of that is completely unconscious, which is what materialists believe, then how come we're conscious? It's a serious problem. And so philosophers of mind, materialist philosophers of mind, fall into several schools of thought. One school of thought, the so-called eliminative materialists, say that we're not conscious. Consciousness doesn't actually exist. It's just folk psychology. And when we know enough about neuroscience, we'll just be able to explain everything in terms of nerve impulses and brain activity. They don't convince many people. Another school of thought says, well, consciousness it's just a kind of epiphenomenon of what's happening in the physical activity of the brain, and it's a kind of illusion. And so consciousness doesn't do anything, it's just an illusion produced by the physical activity of the brain. The trouble is that their critics then point out that illusion is itself a mode of consciousness. So they're going round in circles, and that's why it's called the hard problem, because the very existence of human consciousness doesn't fit into a materialist worldview. It leads to this terrible problem.
So let's just sort of take it step by step. So, you know, the idea that consciousness is an epiphenomena of the brain, it might be worth sort of explaining that. It seems to me that the assumption is that what we're experiencing now really can, it is basically just nerve impulses and so on. The materialist view is that it's all really happening in my head, and this is all just, everything's inside my skull, you're in my skull, everybody else is in my skull, etc.
That's right. Well, that's the standard materialist view. And the epiphenomenon is just trying to say that all these material changes are happening in the brain. That's what really matters. That's what makes a difference. There's no such thing as free will, because it's just what your brain makes you do. But it produces this illusion that it doesn't actually do anything, this epiphenomenon of consciousness, which is what we experience. And it has no function. It doesn't give us freedom, as we might imagine. It doesn't have any particular role. And then some materialist philosophers say, well, wait a moment, it must have evolved. Why would an epiphenomenon evolve that doesn't actually do anything? How would that fit in with Darwinian evolution and the survival of the fittest? So then some of them think, well, maybe consciousness does have a role. It gives us a reason for getting out of bed in the morning and makes life a bit more enjoyable. But the thing is that then, you see, they're now attributing some agency to consciousness. So the other materialists say, oh, you can't say that. That's falling into a trap of thinking consciousness actually does something. Now, you see, I think there is a way out of this scientifically, Do you want me to say?
Yes, why not?
Well, as you say, I've spent a lot of time in the last 20, 30 years thinking about the nature of vision, because I think if we start from our own experience, our most immediate experience, and it's not just human experience, it's any animal with image-forming eyes, including insects, octopuses, you know, cats, dogs, birds, I mean, fish. Lots of animals have image-forming eyes. And I think vision works similarly in all animals with image-forming eyes. Mm. And I think it involves light coming in, images on the retina, changes in the optic nerve and in the brain. All that's exactly as described by neuroscience. But then, you see, if the image is projected out, if something's projected out, then the question comes, if this is a scientific hypothesis, could you detect it?
Yes. That's right, yeah.
Now, that's why I got interested in scopesthesia, which is the scientific name for the sense of being stared at. Mm. If you're sitting with your back to me and you don't know I'm there and I stare at your back, could you feel my stare? Now, as soon as you ask that question, and if you do surveys, it turns out that 95% of the population have had this experience, right, including materialists.
How embarrassing for them.
And also about 95% of the population have had the experience of looking at other people and finding they turn around. Mm. There's a slight sex difference. More women than men have experienced being looked at. More men than women have experienced looking at others who turn round.
We can leave people to work out that,
yes,
can't we?
Yes. Nevertheless, it's incredibly common, even among children, and surveys have shown that this is, even among 7, 8, 9-year-olds, this is an extremely well-known phenomenon. And children take it for granted that something goes out of the eyes when you look at something, which is why children like Roald Dahl's story Matilda, who's got eye beams that can do things, and Superman comics, Superman has beams coming out of his eyes. Mm. So this all makes total sense to children, you see, because they're reacting to what they experience and what they know. Mm. But the developmental psychologist Jean Piaget showed that studying the intellectual development of European children, by the age of 10 or 11, children learn what he called the correct view, which is that thoughts and images are invisible things located inside heads. Right. So most of us have assimilated that view by the time we're about 11, and we know that's the official view, and you're not allowed to think something comes out of your eye and influences other people. Yet, everyone experiences it, some people, on a daily basis. Mm. So how do scientists deal with this? The answer is by total denial. It's a complete denial that this phenomenon exists. They say, well, of course, people believe this phenomenon exists because that's just a superstition or it's just coincidence. You look around, you look at people all the time. If one of them turns around, you imagine you've made them turn around. You just forget the millions of times you're wrong. Mm. And so between 1885 and 1985, I studied the scientific literature. There were four papers in the entire world published on this subject. Yeah. Two of them, the first two, were by skeptics who said this was a false belief and just showed how uneducated and stupid most people were. And the other two had actually did a few empirical tests. Could people really tell in a randomized trials when they were looked at from behind? And they found they could. And when they published these papers in obscure psychic research journals, the overall effect immediately afterwards and subsequent was absolutely zero, total silence. Mm. I think I'm the only person in the world who's working on this experimentally at the moment. Mm. There's a huge popular interest in it. I now have an app. It's called the iSense app. EYE sense, get it. You can, on my website, sheldrake.org, there's a thing, take part, and you get the link to it. This is where you can do it with mobile phones, working with a partner. One sits with the back to the other with a blindfold on, and you either look or don't look, and the person have to guess if they're being, it's a randomized test. Mm-hmm. On the whole, in these experiments, they come out significant, positive. There's clear evidence it really happens. Mm. And my latest paper on this, I'm sorry to go on so much about it, but it's quite topical because my latest paper on this only came out about a week ago, And in fact, I have a two-page spread in today's Daily Mail. Oh. I dare say hardly anyone in this room, probably no one, has seen it. Nevertheless, millions of people will do, because it's on their website. And based on a paper, I've done a study over the last 20 or 30 years collecting stories from people about waking up children and animals by staring at them. Large number of people have had the experience of staring at a sleeping dog or cat, and it wakes up and looks straight at them. A lot of people find this happens with children. In fact, a lot of parents, including me when I had young children, avoid looking at their sleeping babies because they don't want to wake them up. They spend a lot of time getting to sleep. The last thing you want is for them to wake up just because you stare at them. Some mothers have found they can wake up their children in the morning by what one mother described to me as the humane method, which is just to stare at them, as opposed to the more radical method of a cold sponge. And so, anyway, there's a whole two-page spread in the Daily Mail today in which I encourage people to do experiments with their own dogs and cats, filming them and looking at them at random times. And I'm hoping that a citizen science project will be starting this very evening all over the land, and indeed all around the world, with people actually doing tests on this. So anyway, the point is that the idea that the mind is all inside the head, which we're told, is refuted by our most immediate experience of seeing images all around us. And then when the scientist, you meet a skeptical scientist friend and they say, oh, well, you know, it's just coincidence and, these statistical experiments are flawed and all that kind of thing. They'd do anything to deny this. The fact is, it's happening all the time. And I think that it's a real effort to be a materialist. You have to deny so much of your own experience, including your most immediate experience of the world you experience being out there, your mind being linked to the world through every act of perception.
I mean, I was really struck by you talking about experiment, sounds too wrong, the wrong word, but with your son, Merlin, when he was four, I think, where you might be just fun just to hear about that, because I was very struck by that.
Well, I mean, I've been interested in this for a long time precisely because of the very nature of vision tells us about the most immediate experience of our mind. So when I first got interested in doing experiments, so my own children were the subjects of first resort.
And sounds slightly worrying, but...
And when I did it with my son Merlin when he was four, he got it right every single time. I was amazed no one ever got it right every time.
So you sort of sat him in front of
him? I set him down, he was blindfolded, and there was a click sound to indicate a trial had begun, and it was a randomised sequence of trials. And he heard the click, and then within 5 seconds or so, he had to say looking or not looking, depending on whether he thought I was looking at him. And he certainly wasn't cheating. He didn't know, he couldn't have cheated. He was sitting still, he got a blindfold on, etc. And he just got it right every time. And then after a few, I was absolutely amazed by this. And after a few times, he said, Daddy, can we do it with I look at you? So he looked at me, and I got it wrong most of not all the time. But I got it, average score in these tests is about 55%, where 50% is the chance level. And I was sort of about 55%. He was 100%. When he got the idea that you could actually be wrong and started realizing that I got it wrong and you did, he doubted his own abilities. His score went way down. It still was 60 or 70%, but he never got 100% again after I introduced doubt into his mind. It's one of the problems with this kind of research, that by making people, forcing them to guess consciously things that would normally happen unconsciously, you introduce doubt into their minds, and the intellectual mind gets in the way. It's all about feelings, not about thoughts.
But if it is 55%, is that very much? Is that statistically very important? Because it doesn't seem much higher than
not
the...
a very big effect. No, if you take, if we did it here in this room now, if we split into pairs and people did it, I mean, I've done this many times in workshops and things. Chances are it would be about 55%. With the number of people here, that would be statistically significant. When, in fact, there's now been at least 30,000 trials of this kind. No, it's more than that. it must be 100,000 trials, because it went on for 25 years in the Amsterdam Science Museum, this experiment in an automated version, where the computer told them whether to look or not. And 5% on 100,000 trials is astronomically significant. You know, trials when people say that statins reduce heart attacks and so on, if you look at the figures, it's about 5%. You know, right? It's a small effect. With large, hundreds of thousands of people in big trials, it's very significant. And so the effects of most prescription drugs like statins and things are similar in magnitude to this. So in science, this is normal. But you then you can find people who are better at it. And the purpose of my present app, iSense, is to provide an app where people can train themselves to get better at it. And in martial arts, this is one area where people do train themselves to get better. In some of the martial arts, they actually have practices where a blindfolded person is there, a semicircle of people behind them, and the teacher points to one of the people behind and says, tells them to focus their attention as if they're going to attack, and the person has to detect where the stare's coming from. And it's a directional sense. I mean, the, in real life, people don't just feel vaguely uneasy and look around like this. They turn and look straight at the animal or the person looking at them. It works with animals too. And I think it probably evolved in the context of predator-prey relationships. A prey animal that could tell when a hidden predator was watching it would survive better than one that couldn't. And animals, when they're asleep, are their most vulnerable, which is why I think there's an evolutionary reason for working with sleeping animals.
But what does that, going back to sort of my experience of that walk and that feeling of I could die and nothing would care, and that it might, how does that start to change that view?
Well, I'm not sure it casts a lot of light on life after death or what happens when you die, but it, I think it changes the view that you're disconnected from the environment, because it means that when you look at birds or animals, when you're walking around in the natural world, they can feel this. I mean, they turn and look back at you. Hunters and wildlife photographers are very aware of this. When it comes to how you think about death, then I think it's been a natural thought for humans ever since we know the earliest records from caves and burials and so on, that people thought that when people died, it didn't just go extinct, that the consciousness survived death in some form. And that's why the Egyptians built pyramids and people in caves had, you know, ceremonies in caves, and why people had burials, and why the people buried them with lots of gold and jewels and things for the afterlife and so on. There were varying conceptions of the afterlife, but it seems natural to most people to feel that when you die, there's a continuity of consciousness of some kind. And you find it in most religions, or perhaps all religions, because in Eastern religions, the reincarnation or rebirth is the normal way, with, like in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, there's Bardo, there's an intermediate realm. Within, you know, Islam, Christianity, there's a belief in various different theories of the afterlife. The Jews thought in terms of Sheol, a kind of shadow underworld. The Greeks had Hades. You know, tribal and shamanic societies are convinced that the ancestors and the spirits of the dead are a kind of present reality that actually impact on their lives and relate to them. In the Christian tradition, the Day of the Dead, which is really big in Mexico, November the 2nd is the Feast of All Souls, and Requiem Masses happen all over England and every other part of the world for the souls of the dead. I always go and pray for the souls of the dead on All Souls Day myself. So this is completely taken for granted in all cultures until materialism comes along and says it's nothing but the activity of the brain. In ancient Judaism, there were those who thought death was the end, so it's not totally true to say it's never been widely entered. But even at the time of Jesus, you know, the one group of the Pharisees believed in life after death, the Sadducees didn't. So there were disputes which are reported in the New Testament of Jesus discussing it with them.
And in the Buddha's time, you know, some people were nihilists in that sense, you know. People did think in the Buddha's time that their death, that was the end.
Completely. Yes, so there's always been people who have thought that, but the vast majority of people in most cultures have not thought that way.
Yeah.
But with the materialist philosophy getting the imprimatur of science and being treated as if it must be the truth, in our society, people are just brought up with this view. So the default position for most people would be, when you die, it just goes blank.
Yeah. And that does seem very... It's not one that remembers learning that. It does seem to be our instinct that and of course there's a question: if you damage the brain, then it doesn't work. And it can look like it does. It does meet the evidence, that after your parent dies, you can never speak to them again. It's very deep in us, isn't it? This belief. But are you saying that it's mainly a view that we have taken on through...
Yes.
Really, yeah.
I don't think it's a natural instinct to think that way.
Right, right.
And I don't think that people... I lived for 7 years in India, for example. Mm. And among my Muslim friends, I didn't meet any who doubted that there was life after death. Among my Christian friends, I didn't meet any. Among my Hindu friends, almost all of them took reincarnation completely for granted. Mm. And the alternative to reincarnation was not extinction, it was enlightenment or moksha or liberation. Mm. 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 And as you know, in the Oriental, it's in Buddhism too, but it's here in England, when I meet people who are keen on reincarnation, they get very enthusiastic and positive about it. Well, in India, it's not, although they all believe in it, Hindus, it's not regarded as a good thing, it's regarded as a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And the whole point of spiritual practice is to liberate yourself from being reincarnated and having to go through the whole thing all over again. Mm. Oh no, not GCSEs again. and suffering and old age and death and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So in India, and I think derivatively from that in Buddhism, the idea of a kind of vertical takeoff spiritually, which frees you from this endless cycling. You can escape from it. And for Tibetan bodhisattvic lamas, you can voluntarily come back to help others. Yeah. But it's basically a liberation from. But it's not with the extinction of consciousness like going blank, like a materialist. It's entering an enlarged realm of consciousness.
It's interesting because it seems to me that we now think that we're cleverer than that, basically. Mm. That, all of that was all very nice and very quaint, and it's really to do with wish fulfillment because we human beings are deeply egoistic and we can't really imagine dying, can we? We somehow think we're going to carry on at least a few centuries. And therefore these things are just projections of, our desire to live on, that we put all that behind us.
Yes.
We're cleverer than that now.
Is the main payoff from materialism. I mean, it's a depressing philosophy, materialism, because it says we live in a pointless universe. There's no matter of consciousness out there. There's no purpose in evolution. We're here as a result of blind chance, etc. Mm. It's a deeply depressing worldview, which is why I think the endemic disease of modern materialist societies is depression. So it's a deeply depressing view, but the only positive side of it, the upside, is that it makes people feel they're smarter than everyone else. And I suppose there's a certain pleasure in that, feeling you've seen through what all these other deluded people... I mean, when I was converted to atheism as part of my scientific education at school, there's a terrible sort of arrogance goes with it. You've seen through all these people. All these centuries have been building churches, praying, doing things for the dead, building pyramids and tombs. And you've just seen through it all because of science. Right. I didn't know much science when I thought that. And it wasn't as if science had actually looked into it, simply ignored it or dismissed it. Yes, I think that a lot of people feel they've risen above all that and they're modern, liberated, smart people. Mm. Until they take psychedelics. And I think what's interesting about the enormous impact of psychedelics in our culture, which I think is more now than it has been for a long time. I'm old enough to have lived through the first wave in the 1960s and 70s, but this resurgence of interest in psychedelics, I think what it did for me, I first took LSD in around 1970, 71, I've forgotten exactly when, but it was just after I'd traveled through India and Sri Lanka, and already, which had given me a much bigger view of the world than my Cambridge scientific education had prepared me for. But for me, it really did give the sense that consciousness has a realm and power and vividness and range of beyond anything that I'd learned about in my physiology lectures on the nature of the nerve impulse and, you know, dopamine neurotransmitters and stuff. And I think that what psychedelics have done for a lot of people has shown that there's a vast realm of the mind, which is not the same as physical reality, it's not the same as scientific understanding. It may be akin to the dream world in a sense, because we all dream and we all enter realms different from our ordinary consciousness. And in our dreams, we have a body that's different from the body we have during waking life, because in our dreams, we can walk around, talk to people, even fly. And I think the traditional views of life after death, which I think I personally find quite plausible, it's like dreaming, except you can't wake up because you're dead. And when my three-year-old son, my son Cosmo, was three, he said, "Daddy, what happens when we die?" And I really had to think of some simple, straightforward answer because no one else asked that kind of question. So I said, "It's like dreaming, but we can't wake up anymore." And actually, it was the first time I'd formulated it like that, but I really do think that. And I think most people think that in traditional societies. And if you look at maps of the afterlife, like in Dante's, you know, Inferno and Purgatory and Paradiso in Dante's Divine Comedy, it's like a kind of map of a dream world, a dream world-like afterlife. And I think for most people, that would have been the most normal way of thinking. Purgatory in the Christian or Catholic vision, as in the Mexican Day of the Dead and so on, is like a continuation of this life in a kind of dream-like state where there's still a kind of ongoing psychological development.
I mean, part of that, though, you know, if part of materialism is you get to feel cleverer than other people, which I think must be part of why it's appealing, but also, presumably, historically, it was to do with the fact that before materialism, a big motivator for people was what happened after they died.
Yes.
You know, that huge populations have been controlled by the fear of what happens after death, that you will be punished in hell and so on.
Yes.
So a lot of motivation, religious motivation, was if you do that, things will get much worse after you die.
Yes.
So materialism also, at a stroke, got rid of all the endless torments of hell, if you see what I mean. Is that part of...
Or the endless bliss of paradise.
Yes.
Yes, I think that's part of it. And I think that part of this was a kind of liberation. I've actually been thinking about this in the last 2-3 weeks more than before, because my book, The Science of Illusion, is about to come out in China. And it's also just come out in Iran. And it was blocked for some time in Iran because everything that gets published there has to go through the Ministry of Guidance. And the Ministry of Guidance didn't think my book was a very good idea. But apparently they've changed their mind, and so have the Chinese censors. And so I've been asked to write a preface for the Chinese and for the Iran. And these are completely different cultures, you see. One of the things that I think has come clear in my mind just very recently is that in the 17th century, Europe was riven with religious wars. The 30 Years' War on the continent, Catholics v. Protestants. You know, a third of the population of Europe was killed. And in England, the Civil War in the 17th century had a very strong religious dimension, you know, the Puritans and so on. And that was when science was growing up. And the proponents of science often described this as a third way, that whereas religion was sort of fighting each other and quarreling over how you interpret the scriptures and who should be in charge of the church and whether priests could marry or not and whether there should be monasteries and whether pilgrimages should be suppressed or not, and all that kind of thing. Mm. The third way, they said, well, look, we're just looking at nature. It's a machine. It's governed by mathematical laws. Mathematical laws ultimately come from the mind of God, who's a great mathematician. And it was religiously neutral. Mm. And so the science then became attractive to people because it said the mind's nothing but the brain, except there is this spiritual dimension that religion deals with. But as far as nature is concerned, it's all just matter. Mm. And so I think that this, and then Enlightenment rationalists, building on science, which was making great achievements in understanding nature and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, it was useful, it was connected to economic progress.
Yeah.
Then it gained in prestige, and by having this neutral ground, that meant people could feel they were free of the problems of religion. Mm. I think that's one of the historic reasons why in Europe, science got going in the way it did.
And science and technology has been incredibly successful, hasn't it?
It's incredibly successful all over the world. Mm. But the point is that this view of nature that sees it as totally inanimate, unconscious, dead, mechanical, the mechanistic materialism, is not what most people think of nature. In almost all cultures, including medieval Europe, people thought the earth was alive, the stars and planets are alive, as intelligence and spirit throughout the whole of nature, animals and plants are truly alive. Mm. The word animal comes from the word anima, meaning soul. So it's an animistic view of nature, and our ancestors were animists. Mm. Christian Europe was the great cathedrals, the Gothic cathedrals, come out of a kind of animistic worldview, full of green men and vegetation and spirits and gargoyles and things.
I mean, you also say that, you know, materialists, you know, at the weekend are romantics, aren't they? You know,
yes.
They don't choose to have a big, you know, multi-story in the middle of London. They have a
no. They don't. Their dream of a weekend getaway is not staying in some kind of brutalist office block. It's it's sort of a country cottage and wandering in the woods and perhaps doing a bit of fishing or reading Wordsworth. You know, that kind of thing. So, actually, what happened in our culture, you see, was this rejection of Christianity in favor of a materialist worldview where people could feel they were liberated from the problems of religion. They were also liberated from the benefits of religion. There was a great void. People found themselves living in a meaningless universe where there was nothing but their own. So the romantic reaction to that at the end of the 18th century was to say, well, actually, it's not just all about reason and science and mathematical equations. It's about feelings, emotions, love, you know, the drama of scenery, the beauty of nature, the wonder of a sunset. And the romantic poets were writing all about feelings, emotions, etc. And what that did was created this cultural split, which you mentioned, where from 9 to 5, most people are Monday to Fridays, most people are materialists, and the materialist worldview dominates. But then on Friday evening, the cities of the Western world are clogged with traffic as millions of people try to get back to nature in a car. This became clear to me once when I had a friend who was a rapacious businessman. He was, he was a property developer, ruthless businessman. I didn't mind what he did to make money. But then he got enough and he bought this country estate in Suffolk, an Elizabethan mansion house, beautiful estate. Everything was organic. He protected the ancient oak trees. He quarreled with greedy farmers nearby who were rooting out their hedges because they were trying to make a profit. Right. He became the most ardent conservationist at weekends. Right. He totally believed in preserving all this and so on. It was like a split personality. It's a kind of bipolar attitude that people have, and it runs through our whole culture. Mm.
Okay, so I wanted to... we've talked quite a lot, Rupert, there about the limits of materialism. You know, one of the things we were chatting about in the tea break is how materialism is a view that we don't realise we've got. It's not that we're walking around as materialists, we're just walking around in a world that we think is factual, like, Christians used to walk around in a world that they just assumed was Christian. You know, they didn't have a religion, they just lived their life, and that's what we now call it, just as we have a religion, which is, you know, materialism, which we assume to be given. So we've said a bit about the limits of that. I thought it'd be good to try and start to think about, because you've been thinking a lot about, you know, given those limits, what else might be true? You've already said that, for instance, it seems that we see people, that they're, you know, when I look at the sky isn't inside my skull. It's actually out there. And the implications that has, because it suggests that consciousness is not just locked in my brain. But you've done lots of other experiments and thoughts about what might be the case, given the fact that materialism is so problematic. And I think that's becoming more gradually accepted, that materialism is becoming more, is problematic.
Well, in my book, The Science of Delusion, as you know, what I do is spell out the 10 principal dogmas of materialism, which include nature is mechanical, matter is unconscious, the mind is inside the head, psychic phenomena are illusory, the laws of nature are fixed, memories are stored as material traces in brains, and so on. I take these 10 dogmas and I turn them into questions and treat them not as a fact, as if it's just something you have accept on blind faith, which is what most people do. They don't even realize they're accepting it on blind faith. It's just they think it's true. But turn them into questions. Is nature mechanical? Are memories stored in brains? And so on. And then treating them as testable scientific hypotheses, the questions open up. And then new kinds of research become possible, new ways of looking at nature. And perhaps I should start with the laws of nature fix, this is one of my own starting points. The usual assumption is that the laws of nature are fixed. At the moment of the Big Bang, all the laws and all the constants of nature were completely fixed the way they are now, like a kind of cosmic Napoleonic code. Now, this is the sort of standard assumption. Now, it's a very bizarre assumption, because in the 17th century, people had a reason for it. They thought that God fixed the laws of nature and God was eternal, so the laws were nature. Laws of nature were eternal. They were like eternal Pythagorean or Platonic ideas in the mind of God. That made sense coherently, philosophically. In the 19th century, the materialists who were gaining ground in the 19th century said, well, we don't need God, because let's just say the whole universe is eternal, with eternal matter, eternal energy, and eternal laws, then you don't need a God to start it all off, a creator. So the universe became eternal. So eternal laws made sense in an eternal universe. And most physicists thought the universe was eternal with eternal laws until 1966, when the Big Bang theory became the predominant cosmology, which then said the universe began very small and very hot, less than the size of a head of a pin, 14 billion years ago, and it's been growing and cooling down and expanding ever since. We have a radically evolutionary universe. That's new. It wasn't part of classical physics or anything. So then, the idea that all the laws of nature are fixed at the Big Bang has carried over as a kind of inertia from the previous worldview. So most scientists think, well, at the moment of the Big Bang, all the laws must have been fixed because the laws of nature are fixed. So, as my friend Terence McKenna used to say, modern science is based on the principle, give us one free miracle and we'll explain the rest. And the one free miracle is the appearance of all the matter and energy in the universe and all the laws of nature and the constants of nature from nothing in a single instant at the moment of the Big Bang. So then, the big debate within modern cosmology is, the laws of nature and the constants seem to be just right for life to evolve on Earth. They could have been completely different. So some people take a kind of old-fashioned deistic view. Well, that means there must be a God outside nature who fine-tunes the laws and constants and before pressing the start button for the Big Bang. But the more popular view among cosmologists, many of whom are atheists, is, well, actually, there's nothing special about this universe except the fact we're in it. There's actually billions of universes, trillions, quadrillions of actual universes, all with different laws and constants. We just happen to be in the one that's right for us. It's the only one we can know about. So I challenged one, I'm quite friendly with Martin Rees, who is Astronomer Royal. He was president of the Royal Society, Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, the very heart of the scientific establishment. So I said, well, why on earth do you want to have billions of universes? Isn't this the ultimate violation of Occam's razor, the principle you shouldn't multiply entities unnecessarily? Mm. I said, you're multiplying universes to quadrillions of them. He said, yes, but this way we get rid of God. But the trouble is they haven't got rid of God because, as theologians have pointed out, an infinite God could be the God of an infinite number of universes. Oh, yeah, yeah. They've simply proliferated universes. But you see, there's another way of thinking about it, which is what I'm coming to, which is the idea that my scientific hypothesis of morphic resonance, which is the hypothesis there's a memory in nature, that the so-called laws of nature are not fixed laws that were fixed at the moment of the Big Bang, they're habits that have evolved. Nature certainly has regularities, but there's a kind of memory within nature that shapes what happens. Each species has a kind of collective memory on which each individual draws and to which it contributes. And this is a bit like what Jung called the collective unconscious, except I'm saying it's not just humans, it's everywhere, everything in nature, even crystals. A particular kind of crystal has a kind of collective memory of how to form. And this theory makes a lot of testable predictions. If you make a new crystal of a new compound for the first time, it may take a long time to form. But if you keep making it, a habit will build up in nature. Morphic resonance transfers the habit across time based on similarity. And it'll get easier and easier to crystallize. And so it does. It's known that things get easier to crystallize, and chemists just say, oh, well, it's just us getting better at doing it. But the fact is, it's not disputed that things do get easier to crystallize. If you train rats to learn a new trick in Harvard, then rats in Britain and in Australia should learn the same trick quicker just because they've learned it in Harvard. And that's actually been tested, and that's what happens. If a lot of people do a five-letter word puzzle called Wordle, it's a new one every day, published by the New York Times, then during the course of the day, it should get easier for people to solve that word puzzle because so many people have solved it. It's already known that it seems to get easier for people to do the Times crossword as the day goes on, and many aficionados say they much more easily do it if they do it the next day than the day it's published, because so many people have already done it. IQ tests, average scores have gone up by at least 30% all over the world, not because people are 30% more intelligent, but because the tests seem to be getting easier to do, standardized tests. So this is a testable hypothesis, morphic resonance, memory in nature, and it gives us a completely different view of the regularities of nature. We see them as evolutionary, evolving within nature. There's no need to postulate either a deistic God outside nature or trillions of unobserved universes without a shred of evidence. We can have a view of nature and of memory that's very different. And just finally, to summarize this idea, morphic resonance depends on similarity, and similarity between what's happening now and what happened in the past. So if you ask the question, who in the past was most similar to me? The answer is me. I'm more similar to me in the past than I am to you. And that means the most specific resonance acting on me from the past was from my own past. Self-resonance helps to maintain the form of organisms and, I think, underlies their memories by morphic resonance. Well, one of the dogmas of science that most people in neuroscience would never challenge or even see as a dogma or even an assumption, as you were saying, is the idea that memories are stored in the brain. It's just taken for granted. In a materialist world, everything's material. Memories must be material. They must be stored somewhere in the brain. People have spent 100 years and billions of dollars trying to find memories stored in brains without success. But have they given up? No. They just say, we need more money and more time, because then we'll finally track them down. And I think there's a very simple reason they haven't found them. I don't think they're there. And, I think it's a bit like looking for traces in your TV set of programs you watched last night. It's not how TV works. It resonates with transmitters across space. I'm suggesting memories work through resonance across time. It's not stored inside the brain at all. The brain's more like a TV receiver than a video recorder. Now, if you damage the brain, you can have loss of memory. If I damage your TV set, I could cause it to lose sound. I could make it aphasic so that no sounds came out of it. That wouldn't prove all the sounds are generated inside the TV set. Only that that's important for their reception and processing. And in a similar way, I think our memories are not stored in our brains. Whereas the materialists, you see, coming back to the materialist world, memories are stored in the brain decays at death, therefore all memories are wiped out at death. No survival of death. All these religions say there's transmigration, reincarnation, heaven, hell, purgatory, all just childish nonsense, because we now know that memories are stored in the brain and they're wiped out at death. But they don't now know that, they just think they know it.
Right, yeah.
And so that's just one example of where if you have one of the 10 dogmas is that memories are stored in the brain, another dogma is the laws of nature are fixed. Whereas morphic resonance provides a testable scientific hypothesis that provides a completely different view that's much more compatible with an evolutionary view of nature.
I mean, the example of it that struck me from reading you is the example of Dutch blue tits. I think it's Dutch blue tits, at least blue tits. And the, I thought it would be nice to hear about blue tits.
Oh, all right.
Obviously, you've all been thinking that question, haven't you? Like,
yes.
Oh, we need to talk about blue tits now.
Well, the thing is that blue tits, around, some of you may be too young to remember when milk bottles were delivered to doorsteps. Well, luckily, in Hampstead, where I live, we still have this. So every morning, I have milk bottles delivered to my doorstep, semi-skimmed organic milk in a nice bottle that I rinse and return. And milkmen arriving with milk. It used to be everywhere. Now it's a kind of niche thing, confined to parts of Hampstead, I suppose.
Doesn't happen in Bethnal Green, I can tell you.
Anyway, the thing is that around the 1920s, the milk bottles had, in those days, cardboard tops on them. People in Southampton noticed that when they went to get their milk in the morning, the top bit was missing, the cream at the top of the bottle, before semi-skimmed milk had been invented. The cream was missing, and the top was sort of, bits of the cardboard top were lying in shreds. So keen-eyed observers soon found that blue tits had discovered how to open these bottle tops by pecking and pulling off the cardboard top and then drinking the cream. And in fact, a few of them just paid the price, and there were people found and sometimes found drowned blue tits head first inside their milk bottles. But mostly they got away with it. And so this then started, turned up somewhere else in England, and some Cambridge scientists were, through the British Ornithological Society and various bird watching groups, got people all over the country to monitor the spread of this. And it turned out it started popping up all over Britain. And when it popped up more than about 50 miles from where it had been seen before, they took it to be an independent discovery, because blue tits don't move much. They're home-loving birds. And so it was, and the rate of discovery increased until by the time the Second World War began in 1939, blue tits all over Britain were doing it. Moreover, blue tits in Holland were doing it, and blue tits on the continent, where they also had milk bottle deliveries. Then milk deliveries stopped during the war. And after the war, when they resumed again, blue tits only lived 3 or 4 years, so it wasn't as if there were lots of old-timers who said, oh, the days of free cream are back again. It popped up all over Britain. And moreover, in Holland, where there was an even longer break, It didn't resume milk deliveries until 1948. They had serious famines in Holland after the German occupation. It popped up again in Holland almost immediately, everywhere. Mm. Mm. And when I first moved to Hampstead, it happened to us all the time. But then we switched to semi-skimmed milk on health reasons. And Blue Tits stopped doing it. It wasn't worth their while. So this habit's more or less died out now, owing to the spread of semi-skimmed milk. But the thing is that morphic resonance, you see, would help to explain this evolutionary spread, accelerating spread, and not just through imitation, but through it just getting easier to do, easier to learn. Mm. And I think that in evolutionary terms, a lot of behaviour spreads within societies through morphic resonance. And I'm actually, on Monday, I have a talk with a science lab in Lancashire where I'm planning an experiment looking at antibiotic resistance in bacteria, because it's been found that in bacteria, new kinds of resistance pop up. And when they occur in one place, but then they pop up all over the world. Huh. And in a way that doesn't, some epidemiologists who've studied this think it can't just be explained by people traveling on planes and carrying these germs around with them. There's something more mysterious going on. I think it's morphic resonance. We're doing experiments designed to see whether morphic resonance is playing a part in the spread of antibiotic resistance. Which I think it probably is. Mm. But this would have big implications for evolution and understanding what's going on in evolution and for the spread of behaviour. Mm. And so this would give a new way of doing science. This isn't anti-science, which is my opponents say I'm anti-science because I'm going against the dogmas of science. But actually, I think it's more scientific to question these things and to look at science in a new way. I think whole new areas of science would open up in the most exciting way if we go beyond this straitjacket of these dogmas.
I mean, one of the things that is noticeable in your work is that you believe that science should come from what you observe, that it should start with your observation, not start with theory, that it should be science, it should be testing things, you know. Mm. One of the things you've done a lot in your life is test the sort of things that lots of people say, you know, like, you've done studies about dogs knowing their owners are coming home. There's a particular dog in your book that's very striking, we might hear about. You know, everybody that I grew up with always said that the dog knew when you were coming home. Mm. And your vision of science is, okay, well, we should be able to test that then.
Yes, well, I start from natural history. I think science should start from natural history.
In the sense of?
What's actually happening. Mm. When you look at the world, you know, what's actually going on. For example, this thing I talked about in today's Daily Mail, a lot of people wrote in to me saying that they found they could wake their dog or cat by staring at it. So I put out an article online and said, you know, have you ever noticed this? And lots more stories poured in. Mm. That, if you just take one story, it's an anecdote. But I'm of the view that the plural of anecdote is data. Right, and if thousands of people all over the world say they've seen the same kind of thing, then something seems to be happening and it's worth investigating.
I mean, it still could be wrong, couldn't it?
It could still be wrong. Mm. But what happened was that I started having lots of people telling me their dog or cat knew when they were coming home, would go and wait at a door or a window. Mm. And people would at home would know when the absent person was coming, even if it was not a routine time, from the dog's behaviour. I have over 1,000 of these stories and about 500 about cats.
There's a remarkable one about a cat that with a naval, I think it was a naval officer or something, who didn't want to tell his mother when he was coming home.
That's right. That was a neighbour of mine in my hometown, Newark-on-Trent, in Nottinghamshire. I got interested in this when I was working and writing in Newark, and the editor of the local newspaper, the Newark Advertiser, was at school with me, and I talked to him about this, and he said, oh yeah, that happens with my dog. You know, he said, in fact, it's embarrassing. He said, the dog knows when I leave the office to come home. Mm. He said, but sometimes, he said, I meet someone on the way and we go and have a drink. And when I get home, my wife says to me, Roger, where have you been? You left the office 2 hours ago. And then my neighbour, had a son who was a merchant seaman, and he was very attached to the cat. And she said she always knew when he was coming. He wouldn't tell her because he didn't want her to worry if the boat was delayed or if he missed the train or anything. Mm. He'd never tell him he was coming home. But the cat would get very excited. It would go to his room. It would get, and she'd know the signs. And so she'd get his favourite food. When he arrived home, she'd got almost got his dinner ready. She knew what he was coming. She got his food ready for him. Mm. When I said to her, "That's remarkable, how amazing," she said, "Oh, the cat just knows." I mean, she didn't think about it. She just took it for granted. This is happening. And I found more and more people did that. And then I talked to some of my skeptical friends, and they said, "Oh, yes, it's just a routine," or they're hearing subtle sounds of car engines, familiar car engines from miles away and stuff. So they said they didn't deny the phenomenon. In fact, several of them said their own dogs did it.
How embarrassing for them.
Yes. They just explained it away. So I then thought, well, okay, what's the scientific approach? It's not to sort of argue with people, oh, yes, they do, oh, no, they don't. You do the experiment. So we found people with dogs that do it, set up cameras, had them go at least 5 miles away, then come home at randomly chosen times they didn't know in advance, in unfamiliar vehicles. So there's no familiar car sounds, there's no routine. The people at home didn't know when they were coming. We told them when to come through a telephone pager, just gave a signal at a randomised time. And then on the film, we filmed the dog the whole time they were out. And on the film, you see about 10, 15, 20 minutes before they come home, the dog goes and starts waiting at the window. And it started waiting at the window when the person set off to come, when they said goodbye to their friends and sort of went out, or when they called for the taxi. It wasn't anything to do with actually a slamming of car doors 5 miles away or anything. Mm. We did this over and over and over again, and with other dogs as well. This is on film. On my website, if you go to the experiments video section, you can see a video of one of these experiments. So this is a testable phenomenon that had never been done before, and it hasn't been done since in any university, because it looks as if it's telepathic. The dog's picking up the person's intention. But telepathy is completely taboo within the academic world. And the reason it's taboo is because, according to materialism, your mind's nothing but the activity of your brain. Therefore, your thoughts about going home couldn't possibly influence a dog 5 miles away. It's simply impossible. Therefore, anyone who says it's happening, like me, is a pseudo-scientist, because they've either been duped or they've just been done such sloppy experiments they've failed to see the flaws in the experiments, or they've been taken in by people who wishfully think their dogs have powers they don't really have and couldn't really have. And I was treated with incredibly corrosive attacks from skeptics for being a complete fraud. Just instead of saying, isn't this interesting, let's try it ourselves. One skeptic did try it himself, and he got the same results. But then he said that the dog had failed the test because before the person came home, it had gone to the window, went to the window a few times to look at passing cats and things. And when I showed the dog was actually at the window about 3% of the time on his films before the owner came home, about 75% of the time when the owner was coming home, he said, well, because it already failed the test by a strict criterion he'd invented, all this other data was irrelevant. And he then got headlines in newspapers saying it had been refuted. There was one of the newspapers very pleased when they had thought of the headline, "Psychic dog fails to give scientist a lead."
Oh, they're good, isn't it?
Yes. Anyway, this research can go on in people's homes around the land, and most people who are just ordinary dog or cat owners are much more curious and cooperative than people in universities, because it's not because they're not interested. In fact, lots of scientists have told me their dogs know when they're coming home from the lab. But if you do this in a university, you just wouldn't get funding. You'd be attacked by people as doing pseudoscience. It's terrible. And the reason for it is this dogmatic belief in the materialist worldview, which is truly inhibiting curious science. I know I'm talking too much, but could I give one more example?
Yeah, do. Yeah, then I've got another question for you.
Yeah. Well, you keep getting me on these themes, you see, that I'm really... Well, you've read... You know which things trigger me, in at least.
Not in the negative sense.
Not in the negative, positive triggers. Good at it. One of the things I'm really interested in, have been for years, is the way that in many places animals seem to respond in advance to earthquakes and tsunamis. Oh, yeah. There's been reports all through history of dogs, cats and other animals, snakes, all sorts of animals, behaving strangely before earthquakes. Mm. And about 25 years ago, I talked to seismologists, and they all said, "Oh, it's just superstition. These, you know, people just sort of make it up after the event, and they just remember these things, but they forget. If there's no earthquake, they just forget all this thing." So they're completely dismissive. Not the slightest curiosity. It's impossible. It can't happen. So I then had research assistants whenever there were big earthquakes, Assisi, California, Turkey. For years, I had research assistants go there and interview people. After the Assisi quake of 1997, I had an Italian research assistant went to Assisi and, you know, asked the mayor and the restaurateurs and people. And days before this, rats had come out of their burrows and were swarming all around the city. Restaurateurs complained to the mayor that they were losing trade because tourists who were having dinner on their terraces didn't like having rats running around everywhere, and asked the mayor to do something about it. And this was two or three days before the quake struck. So ever since then, I've been trying to persuade universities or seismologists to actually monitor animal behavior before earthquakes, because you could have a warning system. The Chinese actually developed one in the 1970s. I even got 2 years ago onto the head of Google Maps, because I knew someone at Google, and they introduced me to the head of Maps. And I said, look, you could easily have an app that worked on Google Maps on mobile phones. If people see unusual animal behavior, they just press a button. And if you get a surge of reports from somewhere in Iran or Afghanistan or India or Greece or California or something, it could mean there's an impending earthquake. Mm. And so she said she'd have to talk to people. Then she got back, she said, we're not interested in this project at this time. And, you know, because they'd be attacked, they'd be criticized. Mm. The Chinese who did this research and actually started talking about it in international seismology conventions were shamed by the Western seismologists, said you've been taken in by this gullible, you know, folklore and stuff. Mm. But developing an app wouldn't be rocket science, it'd be quite easy. And this is another example of where this narrow-minded, dogmatic thinking and fear stepping beyond what everyone thinks is a consensus reality is actually impeding science. And one thing I'm hoping with the launch of my book in Iran, where they have quite a lot of earthquakes, I'm trying to get this point across in Iran, where they're fairly independent-minded and they're perfectly good at programming things. They could develop their own earthquake warning system based on mobile phones.
I mean, the story from your book about that struck me most was that herd of buffaloes. I think it was in Thailand.
Before the tsunami.
Yeah.
Yes, there were a lot of unusual behaviour before the tsunami. I got onto the head of English scientist who was in charge of the British government's response to tsunamis task force to work on them, and I suggested, you know, finding out what people had observed systematically around the great tsunami of 2004. And document the animal behavior thing as a first step. And he didn't even reply to my letter. His assistant replied saying that he was personally interested, but they saw this as a purely physics problem, and they're going to have sensors, wave detecting things, satellite detection system to get waves, but that wouldn't give them enough warning. So again, over and over again, there's this incredibly narrow, it's not as if these projects would even be expensive. They're cheap, and a lot cheaper than having satellites and wave monitoring buoys and automated equipment costing millions and millions of pounds.
You could just sort of find out what's happening with the buffalo, I suppose.
Yes, just find out, get people to observe the animals. If they see animals behaving strangely, moving away from the seashore in a way that actually, during the 2004 tsunami in the Andaman Islands, the tribal people there weren't affected by it because they noticed the animals doing this and they knew this happened before tsunamis and they all went on to higher ground.
Yeah, wow.
But all the more sophisticated people who thought they were smarter than these primitive tribals were devastated by these huge tidal waves.
So we better sort of start to wind this to a close, but I think it'd be good then, I think, to go to this, what then is consciousness? You know, if we started with this thought that, you know, the dogma, as you would put it, that we've got, which is that mind is merely an epigenetic phenomenon of the brain, that it's locked inside the brain and that it doesn't radiate out. Therefore, at death, it's destroyed completely. Your memories are destroyed completely. What do you think consciousness might be? I mean, obviously, consciousness isn't conscious. What is mind? I mean, it's an impossible question because we may as well go there, mightn't we? You know.
Well, why not?
We're on
big questions.
Yeah.
If we have to step back a bit to look at philosophical discussions, because after all, this has been debated for a long time. But the general view, I mean, all religions. I'm not quite sure about Buddhism. You know, obviously, but everyone except Buddhism, let's say for the time being, takes for granted that consciousness comes first. Mm. You know, God creates the world. You know, God comes first, and God is a conscious being. Every conception of God or supernatural beings or spiritual beings is that they're conscious, not unconscious. And so almost all creation stories or worldviews start with the idea that consciousness comes first. And then in the Judeo-Christian creation story, the acts of division, God says, let there be light, and the light is separated from darkness. There's a series of creative steps in the universe which mainly involve separating polarities. They still happen in the Big Bang theory, only instead of the separation of polarities, it's now called spontaneous symmetry breaking. But it's essentially the same model. The separation of light from darkness is called the decoupling of matter and radiation. But it's one of the first steps in our modern cosmogony. So if consciousness comes first, then everything in nature is reflecting that ultimate consciousness. And when consciousness occurs in people, then it's a reflection or refraction or a fractal version of that primal consciousness. And, you know, when I lived in India, this is just so taken for granted as part of the culture. You know, a familiar metaphor, Buddhists may use it too, is that if you have lots of buckets of water outside on a moonlit night and you look in the buckets, in each bucket you see a reflection of the moon. It's as if there's a moon in every bucket, but actually all those moons are reflections of the one moon. Just as our minds are all reflections of the ultimate consciousness and come from it. Now, personally, I find that a much more persuasive view, a much more convincing view. But it's not something that you could easily prove scientifically, but you can prove. I think the reason that it's been so widespread in the world is that many people, through meditation or through spontaneous mystical experiences, actually feel that their mind is part of a greater consciousness than their own. They actually experience this. It's not a theory. It's not someone saying, you know, this has been observed in experiments and with statistical significance and stuff. It's actual direct experience of being part of something much greater than oneself. And I think that's the origin of all religions, really, that they all start from people who have this experience of enlightenment, a greater consciousness. Which doesn't come through, I mean, the Buddha didn't get enlightened through doing a PhD in consciousness studies. Jesus didn't realize his direct connection with God through going to a rabbinical seminary. It happened at the moment his baptism, immersion in the River Jordan, comes up with what I think was a near-death experience and opens up to this divine consciousness. So this is why people think that, because they've experienced it. And when one looks from that point of view of consciousness as primary, then you can reframe the way you see nature. Nature's still there. There's still the patterns in nature. You can still have science and all that kind of thing. And actually, rather surprisingly, there's a resurgence of idealist philosophy that sees consciousness as primary going on right now. Bernardo Kastrup is one of the leading proponents.
And you're going to be talking to him soon, aren't you?
Next week, we're having an online debate, yes, me and Kastrup, because he takes the view, a kind of rather monistic view of idealism, and he's rather conservative scientifically. And whereas I, you see, I'm against Cartesian dualism. Most people think two is too many, so you've just got to have one. I think two is too few. I think you need three, at least, kind of Trinitarian models of consciousness. And, so, but that's a whole other topic.
I mean, Buddhism thinks that mind precedes world, you know, that's
good. Well, then there does...
That's a given, you know.
I never like to generalise about Buddhism because someone always jumps on me and says, Buddhism's atheist, it doesn't believe in God. And sort of, and you immediately put down the minute you say anything about... And so I'm glad you said that.
I mean, Buddhism doesn't believe in God, but I think what Buddhism would say something like, the experiences that people have... You know, I agree with you, this thing that you know, many people, I including myself, have had the experience of being part of something infinitely larger than us. You know, it seems to me almost that what makes us human.
Yes.
That we're not our materialistic view is that like we're in like in a toy in a box, and eventually the toy breaks and the box continues completely separate from us. And that seems to me to be wrong, and that my experience suggests that, although it's a very deep view. What I think I would then differ on is calling something God. You know, I for me that is a problematic metaphor, but I get what it's, you know, sort of trying to open up.
Well, again, this is, we could have a whole other conversation.
Yes, we could.
You know, I'm a practicing Christian, and for me, God is a Trinitarian, is a trinity of aspects, not an undifferentiated consciousness. And, you know, there's paralleled in Kashmiri Shaivism the knower, the known, and the means of knowledge, and in Satchitananda. There are Trinitarian models in many traditions. And of course, there are three levels in Buddhism as well. So, but this is a different conversation. But the materialist view seems to me such a narrow, and you can see how they got there historically, you know. Rejecting religion because of religious wars, carving out this neutral zone for science, making simplifying assumptions just, and then believing it's all true and truer than anything else. And you can see how it's got there, but it
seems to have
come
forgotten
about
the consciousness on the way, doesn't it?
Yeah,
and then just say, well, it can't be there.
Threw out the baby with the bathwater, and then are left with this, the hard problem. I mean, it's an intractable problem for materialists, the very fact we're conscious. They can't deal with it. Which is why some of them are going over to idealism, and quite a lot, there's a large move towards panpsychism.
Yes, yeah.
And it's very hard nowadays to find a sort of old-style, totally confident, unreflective materialist. I mean, the Dawkinses of this world are now a kind of endangered species.
Well, science, perhaps we finish with this, science does seem to be changing, doesn't it? Because you were, you know, it's very interesting. If you look at Wikipedia, almost the first sentence it accuses you of pseudoscience.
Yes.
And it's just a sort of slur that means that we don't need to, we can happily ignore this person, really. I mean, there must be such a thing as pseudoscience, but it seems to me that science is changing, do you think?
Well, I think so. The point is that the majority of scientists are not dogmatic materialists. The Scientific and Medical Network recently had a survey done by a public opinion organisation, YouGov, of practising scientists, engineers and doctors in Britain, France and Germany. About 25% identified as materialists and atheists. About 20% identified as agnostic but non-religious. That's 45% who were non-religious. About 45%, even here in Britain, identified as spiritual or religious or spiritual but not religious, like spiritual slash religious. So only about a quarter of the, of even in the most hardcore atheist countries like Britain, France and Germany, identify as atheist and materialist. And most scientists go along with at work, they go along with it because it's what everyone believes.
What when you get funding for it.
What you get funded. When I was in India, it was even more extreme because I was working in this International Scientific Institute in Hyderabad, India. And my Indian colleagues were practically all of them sort of fairly conventional practicing Hindus, Muslims, Jains, Sikhs, Parsis, etc. I didn't meet among all my colleagues a single atheist. But when they were at work, it was just conventional Western-type science. They didn't question it, because at work, that's the culture. As soon as they got home in the evening, then they turned back into Hindus or Muslims or whatever. So it's not as if they were deeply committed to this worldview. And in fact, I think the situation we're in now is a bit like Russia under Brezhnev. You know, in the later days of the Soviet Union, very few people openly criticized Marxism or dialectical materialism. Because if you did, you were a dissident, and if you were a dissident, you get sent to Siberia or at best, a psychiatric institution. So, you know, when the chairman of the Central Committee made a speech and all those delegates clapped in their halls and so on, how many of them still believed it when the Soviet Union collapsed? Some did, but it certainly wasn't everyone. And what's happened since the collapse of the Soviet Union has been an enormous resurgence of Russian Orthodox Christianity. Yes. So I think within science at the moment that I know this is true because whenever I give talks in scientific institutions where I talk quite freely about the things I'm interested in, and there's sometimes a few people boycott my talks, you know, because they're so hostile and try and get me disinvited before the talk happens. But most people come along to it. And after the talk, what almost always happens is person after person comes up to me with their cup of tea or glass of wine. They look, see no one's listening. And they say, you know, I'm really interested in what you said. My dog knows when I'm coming home. In the laboratory, you know, I've had these mystical experiences and I can't talk to my colleagues here about it because they're all so straight. And so then another one comes up and they say the same thing. And by about the fourth or fifth one, I usually say, well, actually, you're not alone. And they say, how do you know? And I said, well, at least four of your colleagues have already said something very similar. And they say, who? And I said, well, him. So I sometimes say, why didn't you come out of the closet? You know, life would be so much more fun. So the scientific institutions are full of closet holists, or people with a more mystical view of nature. But it's like gays in the 1950s. You know, they don't feel they can possibly say it among their colleagues. So I think one of the things that will change science is a coming out of the closet movement.
Well, that's a great place to finish. Thank you very much, Rupert Sheldrake.